Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today we'll discuss challenges facing America's teachers with National Education Association President Dennis Van Roekel and the fight to protect workers' rights with Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale. We'll also get an update on Washington's debt negotiations with former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Weiner and financial tips for federal employees with First Command District Advisor Bob Hill. Up first, Dennis Van Roekel, President of the National Education Association. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Jason. It's good to be here.
Now, you were recently elected to a second term as president of NEA at the annual meeting and representative assembly. What are your top priorities going forward in this next term?
Well, number one in my priorities is to lead in the transformation of public education. We've got to lead in terms of our own profession. We've got to ensure quality at the front door instead of, as everybody wants to do, is open the door wide, let anybody in, and then make it easy to fire them. We think that's wrong. You ought to deal with quality at the front end, and no one should be allowed in a classroom with a group of students who isn't highly trained, qualified, and certified. A second thing that is very important to me is that we obviously have to defend against all of these attacks that are coming as political payback to the middle class. They want to silence the voice of educators and of all unions and the middle class, and so it'll be a priority to respond to that. But most of all, we're going to do as our mission states. We want to fulfill the promise of public education for every student in America. And right now in America, the equity issue is a real important issue to address. Many of our students do extremely well in the educational system, but there's a significant group, especially children in poverty, who are not being, their needs are not being addressed, and that'll be a priority of mine to look at that equity issue and to provide the kind of education for every child that every single parent wants for his or own child.
Dennis, you mentioned a focus on quality. How do you go about ensuring that quality education for every American child?
Well, it starts with the profession. We know that there are so many factors that impact student learning, but once they're inside the school, it deals with the quality of the teacher is a big factor, and we need to deal with that. We're going the opposite direction of all of the countries around the world that are doing well. They make sure that the training is excellent for all teachers and that you can't get in a classroom without it. In America, we keep trying to make it easier and easier to get into a classroom to kind of try out teaching. That is not the way to go. It is a very negative impact on students, and we need to change that. A second thing about quality that we have to deal, especially with students of poverty, is the school cannot do it alone. It's going to take all of the community working together with the educational system, reaching out to parents and the community and coming together to say, let's address this problem together and figure out what to do so our kids succeed. That's a critical factor in making a real difference in what's happening.
Dennis, you mentioned earlier that sometimes the door gets opened real wide and a lot of people are trying to make a lot of different decisions from different angles, especially maybe people from Washington or elsewhere who aren't actually in the classroom. I want you to take us inside the classroom. Tell us what it's like to be a teacher, to face the challenges that are present on a day-to-day basis.
You know, I was a high school math teacher for 23 years, and I remember the first day of my first year. It was overwhelming. You know, there are very few people in business, and when they talk about their span of control of direct reports, I saw 160 kids every single day. And within that 160, you have such diversity by race and ethnicity, by language, by family background, by opportunities outside of the classroom, and they're all in there, and you have to find a way to address all those individual needs. And right now, with the kind of budget crises we have, that class size is getting larger and larger and larger. And it just makes it impossible to be able to connect with every single person in that room every day, and that's what you want to do. The students that come in from families in poverty, they haven't had a disadvantage. They've had a, quote, narrow curriculum from age 0 to 5. They don't have the same opportunities, and so you have to find a way to build on what they already know, because they do know a lot and they have a lot of skills, and you need to add to that to add and give them the kinds of things that they haven't yet experienced. And that is a real challenge. In today's world, there are many of those students who are English language learners, which is another challenge. But we know there are techniques and methods that work. So what you constantly focus on is your professional practice. What do I need to do with each and every student and with all of them to create an environment where learning takes place? I can tell you the challenges are great, but if teaching is your profession as it was mine, I loved every minute of it. I loved the challenge, and I also loved it when I saw the light go off in their eyes and they got it. There is nothing more inspiring than to see a student who seems so disengaged and disinterested, and you find a way to connect with them, and they go, now I'm ready to work. Those days just are forever etched in my memory. I remember the face. I remember the names. It's quite a profession.
Dennis, as you know, teachers, like almost every other public worker in this country, seems to be under attack by legislators, either at the state level, the local level, the federal level. Talk about how important it is to recognize what these public workers do, what these teachers do to shape the communities that they live in.
You know, I think this is a classic case of deflecting the blame. For all of the people from Wall Street and CEOs who created this incredible economic crisis, and they did create it, they seem to be standing apart with no recourse to them, no disadvantage to them, but yet they cause it so millions of people are out of work, they've lost their homes, those students are coming into our schools. We have more students who are homeless right now in this last school year than ever before. And so that's what those teachers have to do. Somehow they've deflected the blame and they've made public service workers the scapegoats and the object of blame. What a disservice. You know, when I was growing up, my community told me that being in public service was a high calling, that you give back to the very community that helped you. And there is such a variety of things that people do. You know, when there's a crisis happens, whether it's a tornado or a hurricane, and all of a sudden all these agencies jump to the aid of people who've lost their home and who have such needs, that's public service workers who are doing that. And the things they provide, the whole range of things, you can't have a society that we built in America without public service workers. And the idea that now they're being made the scapegoats for an economic crisis that they had nothing to do with creating is just plain wrong. And the group that is suffering the most, I believe, are students. They're suffering in terms of what's happening to their families. They're suffering with huge class size, elimination of programs that they need in order to succeed. And so we ought to thank every single day those public service workers who are providing, whether it's fire protection, police, teachers, public service workers, they're all doing what needs to be done to support the people in this great nation.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Dennis Van Roekel, president of the National Education Association. Dennis, what is NEA doing to fight back against these attacks against teachers and public workers?
Number one, obviously we have to start it in Wisconsin, and we're engaged in all the recall elections, and we're engaged in communicating with the public. You know, it's not just union workers. So many of the people in the general public recognize that this is the wrong direction for America. America was built on the American dream, and the power of that dream is that the average guy, like you and me, could find a way to make a good living, educate their children, own a home. The middle class is the success story of America, and they're the ones who are being attacked right now. And so what NEA is doing is we're fighting these attacks and saying this is not the direction we believe America ought to go. These attacks on Medicare and Medicaid, where one-third of all children in America get their health care through Medicaid, and they want to get rid of that, that is the wrong direction. We need to focus on the people of America, not corporation and greedy CEOs. So in that arena, we're going to define a vision for America that we believe in, and we're going to fight for that. We'll work against those who want to take us down a road where those who have a lot keep it and no one else has a shot. And we'll also, what we're going to focus on is making sure that every student in America has that opportunity to fulfill the promise of public education. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, about 1,700 people, and everyone, my teachers, my family, my community, all said, whatever your dream is, wherever you want to go, education is the vehicle that will get you there. And so if you work hard and get a good education, you can follow your dream. I did that. For 23 years, I lived my dream as a high school math teacher. What NEA wants is that same opportunity for every single child in America, and that's what we're fighting for.
Talk about the state of today's educational system and areas where you think some improvement or some tweaks would be helpful in taking it into the future.
And not too long ago, the results of the PISA, it's an international assessment, P-I-S-A, were given, and there were a lot of stories written that America ends up in about average. There are many countries that do far better than we do, Finland and Ontario, Canada, and Singapore and others. And so people talk about that, gosh, our education system maybe isn't doing what it ought to do. But there's another part of that report that not too many people talk about. And that is, if you compare the results of American students who go to school where there is less than 10% of students in poverty, we're number one in the world. And what that says is we have a system that does a good job for some, but not for all. There's a significant group that our system does not address, and that is the group of students who happen to live in poverty. One in five kids in America live in poverty. We need to change that. Part of that is preschool education. We know how important that 0 to 5 is, and we need to invest in that as a nation. If you're going to level the playing field, that's the first place you start, is providing that those opportunities for kids before they get to school. Secondly, what we need to do is to engage all the partners in a community to say, we're going to do this together. It can't be the school alone. It can't be the parents alone. It's got to be everybody in a community saying, we're going to pull together. And if we're going to ensure the future of our community, of our state, and of our nation, we must make sure that all children have that opportunity, not just some.
Dennis Van Rogel, president of the National Education Association. Dennis, thank you for your time and insight today.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll hear from Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale on the fight to defend workers' rights.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. Call the AFGE Benefits line at 1-888-844-2343 today to see how much you could save. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jason. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett recently signed his first state budget into law. What was the impact of the budget on state workers?
Well, the impact is going to be long and hard on everybody in Pennsylvania, not just state workers who had to take a 0% increase in this contract year and lost a couple of sick days that they had gained, and you know all those benefits that people get. And while many folks in the private sector don't always understand, there are trade-offs. I mean, whenever a union person negotiates a benefit, it's usually they give something up to get that. It's a negotiation. It's a give and take. So the budget itself, they're going to lose, anywhere from, we haven't heard layoff numbers, But earlier on, we had heard around 1,500 positions that wouldn't be filled. And, of course, people right now are doing, since our state workforce has declined over the last 8 years under Governor Rendell and now under Governor Ridge or Corbett, it's, you know, people are doing more with less. And folks are, that's why you had a lot of retirements. I think people are just, you know, it's tough going out there when you don't have one person doing the work of what two or three used to do. And, you know, the average salary is only $39,000 a year. So people were hardly getting rich off being state government employees.
With a workforce that declined under Governor Rendell and now, as you mentioned, under Governor Corbett, obviously that has an impact on the worker if the worker is doing the job of two or three people. But what's the impact on public services for Pennsylvanians?
Well, that's a critical question, and that gets to the heart of it. Over the years, we had built up a reputation as a really well-run state, high in efficiency, you know, high service. We just did a focus group with some unemployed folks about the unemployment system, the career links, and they came out very, very highly. People like their government services. Problem is, and what we're starting to see, is some businesses who wanted to expand are finding slowdowns in the permitting process. And, you know, the first reaction is blame the state employees because people really don't know how government works. But what's really happening is that because there are fewer state employees in that particular department, things are getting backed up. Overtime is being restricted. So even if you have people doing the jobs, which we do, they are not able to get to the permits as fast as they would like to. Because, of course, we want it done well, too. We don't want people getting, you know, permitted that are going to pollute our streams or, you know, we got to make sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. So we want to make sure that all that permitting process is done right. But we really, you know, folks need to understand there are fewer people processing those permits, so it's going to take longer.
Rick, if I'm not mistaken, the previous budget to this budget was a reduction of about 4%. What's the impact on agencies and programs? Which ones look like they could face some cuts?
Well, I think you're going to see some cuts in, we're already hearing cuts in the welfare program and welfare programs. We had this great program to help people, you know, back in the 90s, everybody wanted folks to get off welfare and go to work. So we had these, you know, these training programs. We had a sliding scale of benefits so that if a person had to take a minimum wage job, they weren't completely impoverished by that. You know, they got some level of benefits and welfare. Some women got clothing allowances to help them, you know, in their appearance when they went for their interviews. Secondhand stuff, nothing, you know, off the racks at Macy's or anything. Secondhand clothes, but nice clothes to help them look good for their interviews and to have a wardrobe for work. And, you know, all those programs have been cut out. So, you know, these folks that constantly say, you know, we got to cut welfare, we got to cut, you know, but we want people to go from welfare to work. We want a world-class education system, yet they turn around and cut $900 million out of, you know, the basic education subsidies. You mentioned you went to high school at Cumberland Valley. You know, you had good class sizes, good teachers, but they're, you know, now looking at laying teachers off, laying off staff. So, I mean, this budget is going to have a huge impact, not only in state services, but in local government services as well, which, you know, do get state funding. Most people don't realize that only about 6% of the budget actually goes to state employee salaries. All the rest is programmatic, whether it's welfare, Medicaid, nursing home care for our seniors. And those reimbursements are going to cut back. So our seniors that are in nursing homes are probably going to see a reduction in staff, which will result in a reduction of care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Rick Bloomingdale, president of the AFL-CIO in Pennsylvania. Rick, in concert with budget cuts and scale backs in this new budget, was there any way to increase revenue?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, Pennsylvania ended up with just over a $700 million surplus in tax collections because the economy did improve slightly, and our unemployment rate is just a little bit above 7%. So some people were going back to work and paying taxes as a result. So we did see an increase in revenues, but we also have a couple of huge opportunities. We have these natural gas drillers who are taking, you know, the natural gas out of the ground in Pennsylvania, which, you know, is a sort of a commonwealth resource, and they're not paying any taxes on it. And, you know, every other state that has natural gas or oil has what's called a severance tax. In Pennsylvania, we have not levied any kind of tax, and these folks are making billions. I mean, you see the CEO of Chesapeake Energy, the highest paid CEO in the country, close to $40 million. And, you know, because Governor Corbett signed a no-tax pledge, even the energy companies are saying, look, we expect a reasonable tax. We expect to have to help pay for the roads that we're damaging because we're sending, you know, huge numbers of trucks over them. We've got a governor who is, while running, signed a pledge that, you know, bound him to actions which may contradict what he swore to do in the Constitution, which was, you know, provide for the welfare of Pennsylvania. So we have that, and, we have corporate tax loopholes. We do have a high corporate net income tax of 9.9%, but hardly anybody pays it in Pennsylvania because they locate their corporate headquarters in Delaware. And they're able to move their profits to Delaware and therefore have no corporate net income, so they're not taxed. So if we close what's called the Delaware loophole, we could, you know, raise significant revenues, and, you know, we could do all this without raising the personal income tax or the sales tax and have money to do things like help people get from welfare to work, help our kids get educated in a way where they're going to be able to compete globally. And, you know, there are things that can be done, but we have a seems that we have an ideology out there that says, you know, let's destroy the middle class. And I don't quite understand it, but it's there, and folks want to take money out of people's pockets, and they seem to be doing a pretty good job of it.
Speaking of that ideology, around the country, state employees have been the target of legislators looking to take away worker rights. Have Pennsylvanians experienced that same treatment?
Well, we've certainly seen from our conservative right-wing legislators, those bills have been introduced, the right to work bills and, you know, those kind of things. But one thing I will, even though it was a tough contract with zeros and givebacks, Governor Corbett did negotiate. He didn't do what they've done in New Jersey or Wisconsin, which was roll back collective bargaining rights for state employees or any other kind of public employee. Those things were, the governor said he would intended to negotiate. He did. He negotiated tough. That's really the answer. It's not taking away the rights, but, you know, if politicians are saying that folks' benefits are too rich, well, you know, negotiation's a two-way street. People sit across the table and work these things out. If there are times when you have to hold the line or, you know, roll back or, you know, do something, then get in there and negotiate them. I mean, that's what it's all about. And if you do a good job, you know, you're going to work with people, you're going to show them the balance sheet, and, you know, people are going to make, you know, negotiators and state employees or, you know, taxpayers too and citizens, and they read the news. They know times were tough. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that, they're out doing a ratification right now. So I'm not sure the contract will be ratified. I assume it will be, but I don't know that for sure. But they understood that times were tough, and so they're making the right decisions. And that's what, you know, this Governor Walker didn't do in Wisconsin. He didn't even sit down with the folks and say, look, we got this budget gap because, by the way, you know, 2 weeks into his term, he cut corporate taxes so he would make sure that he didn't have the revenue. And then use that as an excuse to take people's rights away. It's amazing to me that, you know, in this recession that we're in, that somehow the folks who caused it, the big, you know, the greedy bankers and the big rich Wall Street guys who don't care about Main Street are getting off the hook, and we're blaming folks who, like I said, their average salary is $39,000 a year. Somehow they're at fault for causing the recession.
Rick, my last question for you is, what is the AFL-CIO in Pennsylvania doing to stand up for the workers?
Well, we've got quite a involved program, and we had this big fight on unemployment insurance where they were trying to tighten eligibility to keep people, deserving workers, from getting their unemployment insurance. And we started a grassroots lobbying network, which we'd had before, but we're trying to formalize it and put it in plan. And all the unions, I'll tell you, they came together. And what that is, you know, we could have the best lobbyist in Harrisburg, but if we don't have people back home telling their legislators, you know, support unemployed workers back in the districts where they live and they get their votes, that's been critical. So, you know, we're building a grassroots network. We got, you know, close to 900,000 union members across the state, and we're asking them to make sure they talk to their legislators. So when, you know, when we lobby them in Harrisburg, they know that back home people are watching and paying attention. That's the thing that makes legislators accountable, holding their feet to the fire, making sure they don't do something in Harrisburg that their constituents back home need to know that they're voting to cut people's benefits. And, you know, that's been a huge part of what we're doing. We've done some innovative things with, you know, education and advertising and training. So we're out there on the front lines, going to be battling for workers every day.
Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Rick, great having you on the program today.
It was a pleasure, and by the way, congratulations on the TSA victory. That's huge for the labor movement, and hats off to AFGE and all the workers that participated and helped organize those TSAs.
Thank you, and we certainly appreciate your support.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll get an update on Washington's debt crisis with former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bob Wiener, former Clinton White House spokesman. Bob is a regular Washington insider, commentator on Fox News, as well as the publisher of an op-ed in the Miami Herald that claims trickle-down economics and tax breaks to the rich in an effort to create jobs is just a myth. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jason, and thanks for all you do, both as a labor organizer and as a radio host, to bring the real facts to your listeners.
Bob, let's talk about some of those facts. We are rapidly approaching the deadline to resolve the nation's debt limit. Where do things stand today?
I love watching Mitch McConnell come out and say, maybe we ought to let Obama have his debt ceiling and we just won't raise anything. They have been so boxed into a corner that they cannot imagine the pressure now for cuts on Medicare and cuts on Social Security that they can't see themselves getting blamed for, while the American people support the polls on those. And also, the American people oppose tax breaks for the rich, and the Republicans want to keep them going, whether they're hedge fund owners or oil companies or airplane jet owners. They just want to keep the insistence. And the New York Times today saying that they're being blamed for irresponsible intransigence. That's what Mitch McConnell really is doing. So, as I said, it's like a prize fighter who's punching his way back to the ropes because he's getting beaten so badly, and that's what this overture from McConnell is. But at the same time, the White House doesn't want to say that because they want McConnell to be able to save some face. They want the Republicans to be able to save some face and actually save the country by not going into this crisis that even the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable say is unthinkable, to have the United States not pay its debts.
Bob, explain to the audience the ins and outs of Senator McConnell's proposal to give the president this final authority on the debt limit.
Oh, it's complicated. It would be three separate votes where the Congress rejects a debt ceiling, but Obama could override it, and then as a result, the debt ceiling goes into place. So what he wants to try to do is have the Democrats blamed for expanding the debt ceiling, but the public isn't stupid. It's no different than motions to return a bill to the table or reconsideration. It's just a parliamentary maneuver, kind of an intricate thing. And it's easy to explain in ads that what the Republicans really are doing is not wanting to take the blame for their desire to cut Medicare, cut Social Security, and give tax breaks to the wealthy, to the oil companies, to hedge fund owners, and to corporate jet owners. That's what it amounts to. But he's come up with what Boehner gives him credit for. Mitch has done good work, House Speaker Boehner says, because Boehner couldn't even figure out the intricate parliamentary procedures. But McConnell has come up with one that he thinks would be so complicated that it would blame Obama, but people aren't stupid.
Bob, it seems now through some reports that an effort to get a long-term deal done here is off the table, and the interested parties are really just focused on a short-term deal to keep the nation from defaulting on its debts. Can you get into that a little bit?
Well, you're absolutely right. The Republicans have blocked a long-term deal because they will do absolutely nothing that will take away any of those tax breaks for the rich, for hedge fund owners, and for corporate jet owners, for oil companies. They will do absolutely nothing that will take away those breaks. They will do anything. They will do whatever it takes. And this latest proposal is a way to do whatever it takes to not take away those breaks for the rich. So it's really an outrage. You know, I once recently had a 90-year-old friend who just died and said he never saw a group come in that had nothing as its agenda but to give tax breaks to the wealthy. And Jason, I don't understand it when you're talking about for the good of the country. Are they really that bought and sold in their elections? Is there really that much flaw in the American political system that those who contribute highly, a little bit of money, relatively to the amount of billions that they ultimately get in these tax breaks, I can't believe when they say $3 billion, that's not much for corporate jet owners. $3 billion, that's a huge amount of money. I'll take one of them, you know. So I don't understand how the country allows that. And there could be some serious backlash in the upcoming elections when people understand that all they want to do is cut Medicare, eviscerate all the programs that FDR created, and keep giving tax breaks to the rich. That's their entire agenda. Nothing else matters.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Bob Wiener, former Clinton White House spokesman. Bob, in your opinion, from your position, what's the best way to handle this debt situation?
I love giving McConnell a little bit of face. The problem is that every time that Boehner, that first Cantor walked out, took his marbles and went home, and then Boehner took his marbles and went home, because they had actually at first tried to reason rationally, but the Tea Party blocked them. Now, McConnell is facing the same thing. The conservatives on the right and Newt Gingrich are saying that what McConnell has offered is an outrage because they realize what it amounts to is letting the country go forward in a rational way with a debt ceiling rise and discuss policy matters separately. You don't hold the full faith and credit of the United States hostage. McConnell is actually trying in his own way to contortedly come up with a good thing that allows the country to go forward. I think that's a solution, but I'm not convinced that he won't suddenly, because he hadn't faced it yet, find the same pressure that Cantor and Boehner had from the Tea Party and maybe force the issue and make the United States go into debt for the rich tax breaks that they want. I just don't know if this is a way out. I'm hoping that it's a way out. The White House said that it means that McConnell realized and that Republicans realize that the United States cannot go into debt. That now when you see the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable, the two most conservative business groups saying it's even more important than tax breaks to allow the debt ceiling to rise for the economic good of not only this country but the world. And so when you see that, then you realize that that's the right way to go from all sides. But the Tea Party isn't all sides. They're their own side. I'm hoping that they don't have enough oomph, enough clout to block the United States from making a deal, from both parties from making a deal to allow us to go forward.
Bob, on the issue of tax breaks to the wealthy and whether that would create jobs in this country, you had an opinion on that and recently had an op-ed published in the Miami Herald regarding that issue. Tell us about it.
Well, you're exactly, and thank you for bringing that up, Jason. Yeah, this past Friday, it's recent, and I urge our listeners to go, just click on Miami Herald Tax Trickle-Down Economics, and you'll see it's trickle-down economics hasn't worked since Herbert Hoover. It's a myth to say that tax breaks create jobs, and especially tax breaks for the wealthy. We did a tracking of the facts. You know, facts are always good things. Of all presidents since 1930, which is when the Department of Commerce started tracking GDP growth, gross domestic product growth, and it's 5.4% GDP growth under Democratic presidents who did people programs, and if they did tax cuts, it's for middle and lower, versus 1.6% GDP growth under Republican presidents. So there's factual matters involved here, and the Republican presidents, of course, have been pushing tax breaks for the wealthy and trickle down, as though trickle down never works. The rich don't spend the money; they save the money. They buy corporate yachts, I guess, but they save their money. The poor and the middle class spend the money, and so CBO, in addition to the 5.4 versus 1.6 GDP growth, has pointed out that for every dollar you spend on the wealthy, you're 3.5 times more valuable spending it for middle and lower income, for people programs, for tax breaks for middle and lower. So there are facts on these things. There are absolute facts. So the Republicans, they babble this garbage, Jason, about it's job killing. It's not job killing. What's job killing and what has killed our jobs, our economy, and created this huge debt is giving away our money to the rich. And if you look at the numbers furthermore, you find that there's been a 20-fold income disparity increase, rich versus poor, over the last two decades. 20-fold. And now there's a 23% increase in executive salaries just over the last year alone. So this crock, this absolute crock of giving tax breaks to the rich as though, and they want to do more of it. That's the Republican proposal now. So this crock of giving tax breaks to the rich as though it's an economic fix, what it is an economic disaster that has plunged us into this abyss that we will be in with this huge and increasing debt.
Bob, how do you think the American public would react to a short-term deal versus a long-term deal?
Well, the public, as Obama said in his news conference, doesn't want to have their credit cards go up, their car payments go up, their college loans pay go up. They don't want to see Social Security not paid and veterans benefits and disability benefits not paid. Those are the kinds of choices. They don't want to even see the military not funded, although that's another area. We've spent $4 trillion on the war, according to the latest numbers, when you add up the veterans benefits and health care benefits. The two wars have cost us, and they've been misfires. Iraq didn't have WMDs, and it took special ops to get bin Laden, not 100,000 troops on the ground. So the American people don't want to see the country go into chaos. And when you explain it that way, they are going to be supportive of Obama explaining that this was necessary because the Republicans wouldn't agree to anything that didn't cut tax breaks. So we had to at least agree to a deal that lets the United States full faith and credit and the economy of the United States and the world go forward.
Bob, you've been around this business quite a while. Ultimately, do you think a deal is going to get done? And if so, what will it look like?
Well, Boehner voted for a debt ceiling increase in 2003, and Ronald Reagan supported 18 debt ceiling increases. Every time, absolutely every time, Jason, this is not the first, it's been high politics of the out party blaming the in party for the need to have a debt ceiling. Every time. That's the nature of the beast. This time, though, with the Tea Party, it's exacerbated to the point of no return. But it's the same politics that we've seen every time there's been a debt ceiling vote. So I do see the Tea Party getting smashed this time because they are so out of it in terms of the future of the country and the economy of the world. They're a little bit out of sync here with what's real. And so people are seeing that, and as we get closer, we did want a deal before the fact. Unfortunately, that never happens in the Congress. You always do it at the point of crisis solution necessary, and that's where we're going to be August 2nd. I noticed that the House has even taken it's recess off the table for the week of August 2nd, so we may actually have to go into one of these a couple days into it. That's going to be really bad for the stock market. I mean, if they don't realize that the stock market's going to start crashing if we're a couple days into the August 2nd deadline, then they don't even know where their full support comes from on the Republican side. So if possible, we'll solve it by August 2nd. It's also possible we'll solve it a couple days after when people see what the economy does and what the stock market does, and maybe that's going to be the trigger that makes it solved.
Bob Wiener, former Clinton White House spokesman. As always, Bob, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jason. Great to be with you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll get personal finance tips for federal employees with First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Jason. Good to be with you.
Bob, the U.S. is still feeling the effects of the Great Recession, with many people unemployed and trying to make ends meet. How has this impacted retirement planning and savings?
Jason, First Command conducts a Financial Behaviors Index, a survey of 1,000 Americans, and we do this monthly. And we supplement that then twice a year with 400 federal employees to learn more about their behaviors when it comes to financial matters. And what we're finding is that federal employees are becoming more frugal, actually more frugal than our other middle-income Americans. And this takes different forms and shapes. For example, federal employees are putting more money aside to pay down debt than our other Americans. And we've seen from the end of, from the beginning of 2010 to the end of 2010, that actually increased by 5%. That's a significant amount. In addition, federal employees are putting more dollars aside into their savings and retirement plans than our other middle-income Americans. And we've seen a sizable increase in that amount that they are contributing toward their futures.
Did the Financial Behaviors Index give any indication as to why federal employees were saving more than the rest of the population?
What we're learning, Jason, from both the index, the survey index, as well as from sitting down and talking with federal employees, is that they realize that it's really up to them to plan for their financial futures, because there's so much uncertainty, as you well know, with regards to their employment, the fact that they've seen their salaries frozen for 2 years. There's talk of recalculating how their annuity will be paid to them from high three to high five. And so those uncertainties are reasons we think that federal employees are taking action and taking action now to improve their overall situation.
On the topic of some of these challenges, how do you think federal employees would be best served to overcome them?
We think that, and again, the index shows this, that federal employees who have a financial plan are the ones who are more comfortable and confident about their financial futures. We found that 21% of federal employees have a financial plan, and their confidence level about the future was significantly higher than federal employees who didn't have a plan.
So first and foremost, one needs a plan. Let's talk now about what actually goes into that plan.
Most certainly. We think it's important for federal employees to sit down with an advisor to review what they have in their compensation plan. What do they have with, for example, thrift savings plan, federal employee group life insurance, and the other benefits that come with being a federal employee? We want to take those benefits into account as we help them to chart a path. That path is really based on what's important to them. We think there are what we call three cardinal cornerstones in a financial plan. to include risk management, cash management, and wealth accumulation and management. So, again, using the benefits that a federal employee has and then supplementing them with other products or services inside of a financial plan really, in our opinion, makes the difference. And one of the reasons that the Financial Behaviors Index is showing that people with a plan are more confident about the future than others.
So let's go through some of these steps, these pillars. Start out first with risk management.
Risk management includes automobile insurance, homeowners or renters insurance. And so as you can appreciate, some of those are required by law. But the question is, do you have enough of that coverage based on your situation? We also talk with our clients, federal employee clients, about disability income insurance, because if you don't have an income, the rest of your financial plan really doesn't matter. And what federal employees are finding is that their disability income benefit within the federal government compensation plan is really a soft spot, and they want to take action to improve that situation. As you can appreciate, we just concluded the federal long-term care insurance program open season, and long-term care is another part of risk management. And finally, life insurance is the other part of risk management. And while federal employees have federal employee group life insurance, many of them find that that's not enough coverage for their family's financial needs. And that's a reason that we have a discussion about the risk management cornerstone of their plan.
And then on to cash management. Get into that a little bit.
All of us, from time to time, have emergencies and unexpected expenses. And so having an amount on hand that you feel comfortable with, we think is very important, so that you'll be able to pay off the unexpected expenses that we all incur from time to time, as well as to plan ahead for other expenses such as vacations or furniture for the home, those types of things, and being able to pay for those expenses with cash rather than putting those charges on credit and getting over your head in credit. And that's the reason that cash management is important for all of us.
Is there a formula that one should adhere to when allocating dollars to risk management, allocating dollars to cash management, and then, of course, to investments?
We think that all federal employees would be well served to consider what we call a 5-5-10 approach, with 5% of their gross dollars on a monthly basis going into risk management, 5% into cash management, and at least 10% on a monthly basis into their long-term investments. That's a simple but effective way for people to plan as to how much they will allocate into each of the three cornerstones.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Bob Hill, District Advisor of First Command Financial Services. Bob, what about the federal employee who says, I'm not an investment pro, I don't really know which choices to make?
I hear that quite often from individuals, and again, that may be a reason to sit down with a professional and talk about the different options and opportunities that are available. But if nothing else, Jason, I would say that they need to take advantage of the Thrift Savings Plan, because that's a great way for all federal employees to put a portion of their monthly or per pay period salary into a plan that is for retirement. And at the same time, it's basically out of sight, out of mind, because that's an automatic withdrawal from their salary. It will go into an account that will allow them to grow. And, of course, the important part there, as you well know, is that up to the first 5% of salary the federal employees do put into their Thrift Savings Plan account is matched by the federal government. So we all want free money, and that's a great reason why they should be contributing, when they can, at least up to 5% of their salaries into TSP.
Sure, as you said, it's hard to turn down free money, and if you can at least match that, then you're going to put yourself in a good position going forward.
That's right, and that's what we see, and that's what we encourage our federal employee clients to do, is to take advantage of the contribution that the federal government is going to make, your employer is going to make in your behalf. And again, earlier, as you said, even if you don't have a lot of expertise or understanding of the markets, putting some dollars aside for the future is, of course, very important. We can have discussions with our clients and should have discussions about how much risk they're willing to take, which will help them to determine which of the different TSP accounts or funds that they should contribute to.
When you sit down and talk to federal employees about planning out their financial futures, what are some of the biggest concerns that come up?
I think that one of the things that's universal is making sure that they do have enough money when they decide to retire. will I be able to retire when I want to? And that is really having an understanding of how much annuity they will receive at the time of retirement, as well as what other accounts or what other dollars are going to be available to make sure that they have enough dollars to maintain their standard of living and quality of life. That's key, I think. In addition, federal employees and other Americans want to know what benefits are going to be there, such as their federal employee health benefits, federal employee group life insurance, and those types of benefits. What will the cost be for those benefits in the future? And again, will they have enough money to live comfortably and do the many things that they've been dreaming about and thinking about all these years, but have postponed because of work?
As you mentioned earlier, and as we well know here on Inside Government, federal employees are under a two-year pay freeze. Their health premiums continue to rise every year. Continuing, the situation looks difficult for federal employees. How would you suggest to a federal employee to overcome those obstacles and continue to focus on that long-term goal?
Well, fortunately, the Financial Behaviors Index indicates that, in fact, federal employees, for the most part, are doing just what you're talking about. They're taking control of the situation, and I think that's what all Americans need to consider as we consider the constraints and the attacks that are on benefits now and in the future. So the point is doing what you can as soon as you can and consistently doing it over a long period of time are keys to being successful financially.
Let's shift gears for a minute and talk about those who are at or nearing retirement. As you know, the federal government is looking at a wave of retirees coming soon. Those people obviously need to be replaced with newer workers. But for those who are at that retirement age, how do you guide them going forward into that retirement?
It's a great question, Jason. And what we do is to sit down with these individuals and talk about the cash flow that they're going to have on a monthly basis, again, based on their annuity, retirement accounts that they have, whether it's thrift savings plan, individual retirement accounts, or other revenue that they may have, other assets that they may have, and making honest assessments as to whether or not they will be able to enjoy life the way they want to. And so I think it really requires a financial advisor to not only be a coach, but to also deliver the news, if you will, whether or not someone's going to be successful when they want to retire from federal service. And they may have to make adjustments in terms of when they retire. They may have to consider other part-time employment or changing their lifestyle in ways that they really didn't want to.
Is there a formula for spending down the assets or which pot of assets to choose from first when allocating dollars?
When we sit down with our clients, Jason, of course, we look at the annuity first because that's a steady stream of income for the rest of their lives. And so with that in mind, then, we can look at other resources that they may have available. For example, FERS employees who are retiring now should consider what they will receive from Social Security. That's another stream of monthly dollars. Above that, then, it does depend on the individual's particular situation. For example, do they have a mortgage payment still, or is the home paid off? Will they be moving to a lower-cost area? All those types of things are taken into account. But once we determine how much their annuity is, if they're going to have Social Security, how much that will be, we can then look at the different accounts that they have set aside for retirement purposes, such as thrift savings plans and individual retirement accounts, to determine how much we may be able to withdraw from those accounts on a monthly or periodic basis so that they'll have enough income.
Bob, if people have questions or want to learn more about First Command, where can they find you?
They can go on our website, and that's www.firstcommand.com.
Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, as always, thank you for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you to our guest this week, National Education Association President Dennis Van Roekel, Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale, former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener, and First Command District Advisor Bob Hill. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife.